Do you need an attorney? Call someone you can trust. The Broward County Bar Association, a not-for-profit organization, was founded in 1925 to foster courtesy, ethics, and professionalism, as well as to provide necessary legal services throughout South Florida. The Broward County Bar Association, 3,000 members strong, has attorney members that work throughout the entire state of Florida, as well as nationally and internationally. Remember, the Broward County Bar Association is a referral you can count on. Call the Broward County Bar Association at 954-764-8310 for all your legal needs. A referral you can count on. 954-764-8310. Or contact online at browardbar.org. Non-lawyer spokesperson.
Welcome to the award-winning legal news and review recognized from the Florida Bar Award of Excellence, featuring the law firm of Santucci Fiore Fiel, practicing intellectual property, business and entertainment law and litigation. Located in downtown Fort Lauderdale is Mike Santucci, legal panel attorney who co-chairs the intellectual property section of the Broward Bar. Legal News and Review, the only real problem solver radio program using the law, with your moderator Philip Bell and legal panel attorney Gary Singer, chair of the Broward County Bar Association's Real Property Section. Gary Singer is board certified in real estate law, also syndicated columnist from the Sun Sentinel. He is an expert in his fields of practice. And nationally known criminal defense attorney Gary Ostro, Esquire. Over 30 years defending the accused in both state and federal courts. With over 500 jury trials to his credit, Gary Ostro's practice focuses on Fourth Amendment issues as related to search and seizure, as well as federal civil rights cases against police officers, as well as the departments and city in which they operate. Now, here's your moderator, Philip Bell.
On the docket for today's broadcast, to err is only human, but that's the last thing we want from our medical providers. Between 210,000 to 440,000 patients each year who go to the hospital for care suffer some type of preventable harm or injury, but most medical errors that lead to death aren't recorded. And now there's a call for a sweeping change in death certificates to better tabulate fatal lapses in care. Right now, medical errors is the third leading cause of death here in America, behind heart disease and, of course, cancer, which is second. Today, we're very pleased to have Peter Spillis from the law firm of Kelly Ustaw, who will be giving us the 411 on medical malpractice. But first, I'd like to welcome and introduce our legal panel host. First of all, good afternoon, Michael Santucci.
How are you, Phil? Good to see you.
Absolutely. Another day in paradise. And good afternoon, Gary Ostro.
I've been waiting for your introduction, Phil. I've been sitting here patiently. Finally, you got to me, so that's good.
And certainly not last, our anchor, Gary Singer. Good afternoon.
Well, that was last, actually.
Yeah, it's
Phil.
Last.
You know, Phil, it's been so long since I've seen you, I barely remembered you.
I know.
You made it through the storms okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're looking good.
And I lost 10 pounds.
You did?
Yeah,
did you really?
I actually see that.
Did. Yeah.
What happened? Your dog ran away?
If you need a drum roll. It's good to start the program on a light level because this is a very serious topic. We have family members. We have friends. We have people that we know have gone into hospitals, and they've had some horrendous, horrible, catastrophic injuries. And we're going to be speaking with Peter Spillis, who has more than 20 years of experience in high-stakes civil trial work. Much of it is as a defense counsel, where he worked with some of the largest insurance companies in the whole world. Now he uses his insight and experience with the insurance industry to help protect the rights of individuals and families who have been catastrophically injured or killed. First of all, Peter, welcome to Legal News and Review.
Hi, Phil. Glad to be here.
Appreciate you coming in. Now, Peter, you proudly also serve on the board of what's called ABOTA.
Yes.
And for attorneys that are practicing, they know what an accolade that is. Before we actually begin, why don't you explain to the general audience what that actually means?
ABOTA is the American Board of Trial Advocates. It's a national organization comprised of local chapters in most of the larger jurisdictions in every state in the country. It's invitation only, and it is made up of equal numbers of plaintiff's trial attorneys and defense trial attorneys. It is my favorite organization I've ever been involved in, I'll tell you that. and primarily because of the uniqueness of it. Number one, it's you know that somebody who is in a BODA has already passed the minimum requirements of a certain amount of jury trials as lead counsel.
Right.
They've already been vetted, and they've been voted on, and it takes 70% of the membership to vote somebody into the organization. So you know that anybody that you meet within the organization nationally is somebody who has been through that vetting process and passed it. And number two, since it's made up of equal numbers of plaintiff and defense counsel, it's not so territorial. And the primary purposes of the organization are two. One is to promote professionalism mm-hmm. within the industry, and number two is to protect the right to trial by jury. And so those are the two most important factors in what we do, in my opinion. And when you've got a national organization of people that are focused on just those things, it's really quite a resource to have.
I mean, it's the same group. Our good friend Charles Moorhead is.
Absolutely. Charles is very involved in the Fort Lauderdale chapter. I believe he's a past president of the Fort Lauderdale chapter.
He is, and past president of the bar, and was one of our legal panel hosts.
Past host of the show.
That's right.
Past co-host of the show.
Started with you, Gary.
Yeah, good man.
Now, the first question I have before the other attorneys get into it, and this has to do, what actually is medical malpractice?
Medical malpractice is another name, really, for medical negligence. Medical negligence, as defined in Florida, is, at its simplest, the failure of a healthcare provider to use reasonable care under the circumstances. What's important about that is it's not a standard of perfection. The law recognizes that healthcare providers cannot be perfect, and that is not the standard to which healthcare providers are held. The standard simply is if you are going to take on the responsibility of taking somebody's health into your hands, you have to have the requisite amount of knowledge, and you have to act with reasonable care under the particular circumstances. That's the bar. And if you do that, then there's no medical negligence in that situation.
Peter, this is Michael Santucci. Do these medical negligence cases follow kind of the same track as like any other negligence case or personal injury case? Or really, how long, what's the range of time that they take to resolve?
Well, in general,
any special circumstances that would cause them to be resolved more quickly or take longer?
Unfortunately, the latter. Generally, they take considerably longer because there is a statutory setup in Florida whereby you can't bring a medical malpractice action unless you've gone through a procedure that's been set forth in the statutes. It's called the notice of intent.
So, how does that work?
Well, before filing any lawsuit, you have to first do your investigation. You have to get those medical records. You have to learn everything you can learn about the case. And then you have to go find experts in that field or those fields. More often, it's more than one. And those experts have to sign an affidavit to say that based on their review of the materials, the chart, everything that they've learned, that they believe there exist reasonable grounds to pursue a medical malpractice case. Once you've done that, you then serve that notice on those prospective defendants, and that starts a 90-day period where all of the sides are supposed to come together, informally exchange information, and try to determine if this is a case that should be settled, if this is a case that, in fact, one of the options that prospective defendant would have is to basically not contest liability and send the case to arbitration, or they can do none of those things, and you can proceed to then filing a lawsuit and going down that route.
Why do you think medical professionals need, or playing devil's advocate, deserve that extra screening that, in another case, if I leave some water on the floor and somebody slips and falls today in my office, you don't have to get an expert first before you sue me. Why don't I get that same sort of protection where you have to go and pay an expert first to give an opinion before suing me?
It's a great question, and I think the simplest answer is this. If I run a stop sign and I hit another car, if you're on the jury and you're a layperson, you understand what running a stop sign means and that I'm not supposed to do it, mm-hmm. and you get that, and you don't need some expert to tell you what that is. Medical negligence is different. Most people sitting in a jury are not doctors, and they wouldn't have a way of knowing whether a particular action didn't meet that standard, wasn't reasonably careful under the circumstances. Mm-hmm. And so that pre-suit period is meant to be an opportunity to go and speak to people who really are knowledgeable, those experts, and make sure that there's really something there, mm-hmm. so that you don't go forward with cases thinking there might be a case and put a doctor or a hospital or a nurse through that when really at the end of the day there wasn't an inappropriate action.
So a long case isn't going to be, you know, you're not going to initiate a lawsuit based on a lay person's opinion or even a lawyer's opinion of a medical issue. And is that really the intent behind it? Or is this about a lobby effort that's very strong?
I think the intent was just that. But there is some of both, right? Yeah, the intent was that, certainly. I won't cast stones, but in practice we see that often it just unnecessarily adds to the expense and to the time.
Well, let me ask you this, Peter. This is Gary Singer. So if you have all these hoops that you have to jump through, then why are doctors seemingly always whining about tort reform and the need to, oh, it makes it so hard and so expensive, we're getting sued? It would seem that before they're getting sued, there's a lot of, you know, maybe necessary, maybe unnecessary, I don't know, rigmarole that needs to be jumped through that they're just not being sued frivolously. So why the whining?
I'd hate to use the term that's in vogue right now of fake news, but there's some applicability to that. The statistics bear out the reality mm-hmm. that of all of the types of lawsuits that get brought, the type of lawsuit that is least amenable to bringing a frivolous suit is a medical malpractice.
It would
suit.
Seem, right?
Because of that prerequisite.
Or was that a dog whistle?
I mean, partly. But
one or another term out there.
That's one of the many reasons.
I mean, yeah.
Right. They're very expensive to bring for the attorneys who bring them. There is a considerable amount of risk. And you're going up against some of the best trial attorneys in the country. There's nothing easy about it. And you have to get qualified, competent medical experts who are going to stand up to cross-examination, who are going to be able to explain to a lay jury exactly what happened here.
And are presumably very expensive.
They're expensive. Yeah. And, doctors aren't in the habit of just putting themselves out there and getting behind a case that's not a real case.
Peter, I have a question, Gary Ostro. And I do criminal work, but I've screened, at least I think I have, cases that might have been potentially med-mal. And it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that every day malpractice is committed 1,000 times at a medical facility. Malpractice is. But whether or not there's enough of a basis to bring a lawsuit is a whole different question that I want you to answer. What are the elements? And I want to get into causation. And is there still a statute that exists that if you bring a medical mal case and you lose, that the plaintiff or counsel for the plaintiff is liable for the fees of the doctor?
There is no such statute per se. There is a statute which could potentially result in a party who – what happens is there's a statute that provides for these proposals for settlement. It's a means by which you can propose to settle a case for a certain number. Both sides can do it. If it's not accepted, and then you go on to a result at trial, which meets certain requirements, you beat that proposal by a certain percentage, then potentially you could be responsible for the payment of the attorney's fees and costs from the time that offer was made.
The same rule that's alive in the civil arena, not restricted to just medical mal, but offer of settlement.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So what goes into an analyzing or screening a malpractice case beyond just the malpractice issue? Because a lot does as a practical matter. Tell us what those things are.
You're right. Well, there's two things there, really. Mistakes happen in medicine just like they do anywhere else in the world. So a mistake per se isn't medical negligence. Getting back to that basic definition, it's got to be a mistake where a reasonably careful physician in the same setting would expect that level of care, right?
Wouldn't you agree that the injury has to be catastrophic enough, maybe that word's a little bit strong, but severe enough to warrant a malpractice case in the investment that's warranted,
right,
financially and otherwise?
So the legal standard doesn't change. You could malpractice could occur, and it could result in – it does have to result in an injury, but that injury could be very minor, and legally you would have a malpractice claim. But as a practical matter – getting back to the fact of how much goes into these cases, how expensive they are to work up, to bring in the first place, we never want to take on a case where at the end of the day we don't feel like we have a good possibility of making our client happy.
Well, significant damages, right? I mean, that's just as important as the malpractice, isn't it? You're not going to bring a claim for a $10,000 injury claim.
Exactly. Your client would never... you wouldn't be doing right by your client.
So no med mal's
more
claims court?
There isn't one, no. And so more would get spent on the cost of bringing the case than they would get.
I've seen people bring malpractice cases against dentists and small-level stuff in small claims court and resolve stuff. I've seen it. Doesn't happen a lot. They don't know about these statutory requirements, but I've seen people do that. I'm sure it's the exception, and I understand how complicated, time-consuming, and expensive these cases are. So I have the utmost respect for
it. Pete, let me ask you this. You know, you have a lot of experience, obviously, dealing with these things that happen in the medical field. Why do you think some of these mistakes are happening? Is it just because there's bad doctors, or is it more, you know, procedural or societarial issues?
I'll use some strategery in answering
please do. Thank you. Societarial strategery.
That's a good question. But that is a good question.
That could be your new band, Mike.
There you go. That is a good question, though.
So it is a very good question, and this is the answer. It's two parts. Number one. There are cases that I have seen over the years which are caused by just bad doctors or just bad nurses. That happens, and that is out there. It happens often in communities like South Florida, where you have a lot of international physicians and nurses who are trained overseas and then come here and get their license. But I will tell you that that is not the more common. The more common case is a case that either through miscommunication or just not having their head in the game, or being too busy, something got dropped, something got missed. With a person who could be another wise, competent nurse or doctor or healthcare provider.
Because it seems with the pressures that the health insurance, the current health puts on, that doctors are forced to see so many patients in a given day that it would become almost impossible to give good care.
I believe that that is one of the primary drivers of this problem, and it's illustrated by what you see now in the way people get admitted to hospitals. In the old days, you guys probably remember when we were younger, you'd have a primary care physician that you'd go to, your family doctor, and he would sort or she would know your history and the things that have happened with you. And then if you showed up in an emergency department and that emergency room doctor said, "This is a serious problem, I need to admit you," they'd say, "Who's your primary care doctor?" And that would be your doctor. He'd be your attending in the hospital. And he would call in those other specialists, and he would sort of be the quarterback for your care. Doctors today, because of the rates they get paid to see these patients through these insurance companies, they are forced, if they want to keep their doors open, they're forced to see unbelievable numbers, sheer numbers of patients. And they've got to see them in that office practice, and they fill their days with those office visits. They can no longer afford to now leave and go see you in the hospital and be your attending. So a whole new breed of doctor has come up. They're called hospitalists.
Hospitalists.
And they don't know you. They don't have a relationship with you. They have a contract with the insurance company. So when I go to that emergency room doctor now and he says you need to be admitted, he says, not who's your primary care doctor. He or the staff says, who's your insurance?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, and you're with insurer X. Okay, Dr. Jones is going to be your hospitalist. And that's, he's never met you in your life.
Just great, isn't it?
Yeah.
But one trend is doctors going bare, where they don't have malpractice insurance. If our listeners has a doctor, then when they go to the receptionist, you know, to the room, the receptionist, and there's a sign that says doctor no longer carries malpractice insurance, what should they do?
That sign exists because there is a statute called the Financial Responsibility Statute in Florida, which I think should be called the Financial Irresponsibility Statute, because the reality is it gives physicians a means of practicing without consequence, in large part. They can put that sign there, and they can practice, and they can, no matter how egregious the act, if they commit malpractice, you can be left with no way to hold them accountable. The only teeth to that financial responsibility statute are that if there were a judgment against them, they would need to be able to satisfy a judgment up to $250,000 total.
Peter, if a case comes in and you evaluate the case and you see it's malpractice and the doctor's unprotected, meaning he has no coverage, do you guys do anything beyond that to see if he's got assets and go after him personally, or do you just look at it and say, you know what, this guy doesn't have coverage, he's got a thriving practice, but we're not going to get the $5 million that you would get had he had coverage?
Depending on the case, we will look, and there are cases that we have brought against doctors who are uninsured. Florida is one of the best debtor states in the country.
For collecting, so, you mean?
Against, no, it's one of the best states to be in if you're worried about having debt against you. Yeah,
I'll tell you, and if they have that sign up, they're unless they're an idiot, they're functionally broke. One of my good friends, actually an old boss, Josh Bennett, right in town, and there's others, have an entire practice on making doctors functionally broke. So if the minimum that they need to have is 250, I guarantee you they have 250 if they have that, and not a penny more unless they're a fool.
You're absolutely right.
Which means sometimes you probably do get lucky because people are fools sometimes. But
you mean like judgment proof?
They have make themselves purposefully judgment-proof with very
planning.
Legal, appropriate asset protection strategies. I mean, I work for the guy. They work. They work. He's a good guy for those doctors.
It sounds like some of these guys are better off being uninsured if they want to avoid being the target of litigation.
Clearly.
That's a strategy, right?
Yeah.
And it happens. It happens, I think, all too often. Here's the downside of that strategy for the physicians who choose to do that. Number one, as I said, there are cases where I find out what happened and I just don't care. I'm going to go after the doctor anyway because it's that egregious. Number two, sometimes there are a number of parties involved and you need to account for everyone. And so sometimes even though they may be uninsured and you may think this might not be worth the effort, you know you need them in there. And when you do need them in there, they are defended in that lawsuit. And now they're there without insurance coverage. Now they're there without any safety net.
And
they've got to
defend
themselves. Yeah. They've got to defend themselves. Yeah. They've got to hire that attorney. Sure. And they don't sleep as well at night as they otherwise
Peter,
would.
Peter, for our
so
listeners.
Without consequence.
For our listeners, from a trial attorney's standpoint, explain why you need to name that doctor when there's lots of potential people or parties liable. Why do you not want to leave one of them out?
Sure.
You know,
one of the most effective defenses is to point to somebody else who's not there. Right.
Huh.
So,
well, the more defendants you have, the more chance you have of a collective recovery or a global settlement. That would be also true or not necessarily?
It could be partially true, but the more defendants you have, also the more complicated it gets. The more good attorneys are able to come up with different theories.
I don't mean to cut you off, and I apologize about Gary Singer. We're actually getting a little short on time, and what I'd like to know for our listeners is, how does someone know if it's time to reach out to someone like you if they've had a problem or been injured by a doctor?
The safest thing to say is, if in doubt, call somebody.
If in doubt, reach out.
If in doubt, reach out. There you go.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like
Can you protect that?
Time is not your friend.
Does it cost money to talk to a medical malpractice attorney?
It does not. It does not. We field dozens of calls every day. It costs nothing to talk to us. It costs nothing, frankly, ever, unless and until we take your case and we recover something for you.
Do most calls turn into something real, or is it generally you have a nice conversation, there's no way to help them? Not to dissuade people, but...
But there is a reality. As we talked about, medical malpractice cases are difficult. There's a high threshold. And so most of the cases, the calls that we get, we don't end up taking. We're very selective. We want to make sure that if we take a case, it's because we believe in it. And we believe that at the end of the process, our client is going to be better off for it.
And let me ask one more question, if my co-hosts don't mind. How do you deal with the emotional outcomes of dealing with people who have been grievously injured?
I think that's just human nature. You know, if you're with somebody who's grieving, you feel for them and you grieve with them to that extent. And, you know, at our firm, it's kind of like a big family. It's very unstructured. We do a lot of things socially together outside of the office, and we involve the clients in that as well. So once they come in, once they're our client, they're part of the gang.
Gotcha.
And we grieve with them, and we laugh with them, and we try to do
Must
what
be
we
hard,
can to help.
Must be hard.
Peter, Kelly Ustahl, you guys don't advertise. You strictly get referrals.
You won't see us on a billboard. That's
right, you won't see on a billboard or things along those lines. But you're a large firm with great resources. You even have a mock trial room in your firm.
Indeed. It's one of the great resources that we have is the ability to take on these cases that can last for years and that can require a significant amount of money to be put into them.
Because your firm invests in the case. If you believe
Absolutely.
In it, you shared with me one doctor from New York charged $60,000 for an expert testimony.
Absolutely.
And he was worth it, I guess.
For testimony at trial or for the affidavit?
He was a pediatric neurologist, and he visited with our client on two different occasions, evaluated him, and then he sat for his deposition, and then he prepared for his trial
But
testimony.
The initial affidavit alleging malpractice is $15,000-$20,000, give or take.
It just depends on the case. It can vary, yeah.
Well, Peter, let me ask you this. If someone did have the misfortune of thinking they've been mistreated by a doctor, how would they get in touch with you?
You simply call Kelly Ustahl. The easiest thing to do is just call the firm. 954-522-6601. That's 522 6601.
What about on that interweb?
The old interwebs, internets, you can punch in justiceforall.com.
That's a great name.
And in a couple of clicks, you'll be talking to somebody who can help you.
Fantastic.
That's, well, that's a Metallica album.
I know. I wonder if there's an intellectual property issue there.
Yep. There is,
well,
that.
Look, it's went too quick. This is such a – we could talk about it for hours. I want to thank you very much for coming on, and your passion is clear. And, you know, I always like Boda attorneys. I know they're always great. So that's fantastic.
They are.
You're involved with that.
Elite
I want to thank you, Phil, Gary, Mike. I know I'm getting some nasty looks from our producer, so we're out of time. And most of all, I want to thank our listeners for sticking with us through this nasty hurricane season. And remember, folks, be safe and
be legal.
You've been listening to the award-winning Legal News and Review, recognized by the Florida Bar's Award of Excellence. Legal News and Review. Featuring Michael Santucci from the law firm of Santucci Priori, located in downtown Fort Lauderdale, and practicing intellectual property, business, and entertainment law and litigation. They can be reached at 500law.com or at 954-351-7474. To contact the legal panel hosts and guests, go to belegalbuzz.com. And to reach Gary Singer, board-certified real estate and syndicated columnist, appearing in 400 media outlets, including the front page of the Money Section every Monday in the Sun Sentinel, from the law firm of Gary M. Singer, PA, call 954-851-1448 for legal news and review. Remember, be legal.
Do you need an attorney? Call someone you can trust. The Broward County Bar Association, a not-for-profit organization, was founded in 1925 to foster courtesy, ethics, and professionalism, as well as to provide necessary legal services throughout South Florida. The Broward County Bar Association, 3,000 members strong, has attorney members that work throughout the entire state of Florida, as well as nationally and internationally. Remember, the Broward County Bar Association is a referral you can count on. Call the Broward County Bar Association at 954-764-8310 for all your legal needs. A referral you can count on. 954-764-8310 or contact online at browardbar.org. Non-lawyer spokesperson.